This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. You, your spouse, your kids, your patient, someone you know is obese. By now we know all the alarming statistics about obesity and health, but most of us don't know what to say or how to say it or what might work. With tobacco, a combination of personal and social pressure and new kinds of laws have helped reduce smoking. So now, with a new understanding of obesity as a public health issue, the government is trying one of the same ideas it used against tobacco. Public service announcements. In just a moment, we'll talk with the head of the Advertising Council about the ads, their message, and why she thinks they might work. We'd like to hear your reaction to them as well. But most of the program will focus on the larger question about how and whether and when any of us decide to do something about our own weight or talk to someone else about theirs. How do we sell the often unpalatable prescription of diet and exercise? How do we avoid unintended insults that might make the problem worse? What makes this such a tough issue to talk about? Later in the program, some ideas to reform physical education, PE for life. But first, how can you tell somebody that they need to lose weight? Does fear work? Guilt? Shame? What about kids? How should doctors talk with their patients? And if you've made the decision to lose weight, what was it that changed your mind? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And joining us now is Peggy Conlon, President and CEO of the Ad Council, the folks who create the PSA campaigns, including the recent Small Steps campaign to tackle obesity. And it's good of you to join us today.
Thank you, Neil.
So what's the goal of this Small Steps campaign?
The goal of this campaign is to give the American people things that they can do, that they can incorporate in their everyday lives, that will help to incorporate more physical activity and better nutrition.
And the message, is at least as far as I've seen, seems to be consistent personal responsibility.
Well, yes, it is. We did a lot of research in preparing to produce this campaign with McCann Erickson, the pro bono agency that did the work. And basically what we found was that the American people feel that losing weight and incorporating exercise into their daily lives was a Sisyphean task, and that they basically thought of it as having to join a gym, having to work out at least an hour a day every day of the week, and when in fact they really aren't going to do those kinds of things. We have young family builders who are working fathers and mothers, and they really have their hands full. Mm-hmm. So the purpose of this campaign and the website that it fulfills to is to give people small steps that they can incorporate into their lives without having to do anything really to disrupt their daily routine. Things like taking the stairs instead of the escalator, or snacking on fruits and vegetables instead of sweets.
Now, experts agree, as I'm sure all your research showed, losing weight is very difficult. As you say, for a lot of people, just the idea of how to approach it is overwhelming. But some critics have said that when a campaign like this makes it sound easy, that's a little unrealistic.
Well, we're not saying that it's easy to lose weight. What we're saying is that there are choices that you can make throughout your everyday routine, and it's called the power of small steps, because what we're saying is that these things in and of themselves are small steps, but they really build up. Get off the bus, a stop early, and walk the rest of the way. Park at the outer perimeter of the mall. Walk a little extra. There's a lot of things. Play with your kids in the park. There are many things that we can do that that won't mean incredible changes in our lifestyle.
Yeah, don't have to run the New York Marathon.
No.
Yeah. Now, we're going to be talking for much of this hour about how all of us approach people with talk about our or their weight problems. Why did you pick on this approach as the best way to talk to all Americans?
Well, we really felt that this was an empowering message. We felt that this was something that people could see the examples and say, well, sure, that's something I could do. I could decide to have an apple after 9 o'clock at night instead of a cookie, or I could take the stairs at work instead of the elevator. And so we really felt that these were day-to-day tasks that no one would see as being too difficult to do and really make a change in their lifestyles.
Well, let's listen to one of these new public service announcements about obesity.
Attention shoppers, if anyone is missing a rather plump set of love handles, please come to the customer service counter and claim them. The ample love handles were lost in the produce department where their former owner had purchased fruits and veggies to munch on during the big game. Thank you and have a good day.
Small step number 81, snack on fruits and veggies. It's just one of the many small steps you can take to get healthy. Learn more at www.smallstep.gov.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
So a couple of questions about that. First of all, you know, there are a lot of different approaches to this, and you've tried humor. Why that?
Well, we really felt that it's a breakthrough strategy in a cluttered media environment. We think that it will get some buzz going, some word of mouth, and we really believe that it's important for people to share this kind of information with one another. It was a real... non-threatening way to do it.
Mm-hmm. But this advertisement presumably is going to come right between the beer ad and the pizza ad.
Well, we have no control over that, but given the fact that there's a lot of food and beer advertising, I guess it's fair to say that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, do you think it's really going to change behaviors?
I do. We've focus group tested this work extensively, and we really do believe that it strikes the right tone with people and that they walk away from seeing the work saying, you know, those are things that I can really do. And we've proven over the years that these kinds of messages that are research-based and that are tested well with the target audience do, over time, really make a big difference. Look where we are with our Friends Don't Let Friends Drive Drunk campaign that's been out there for 20 years. We really have changed the social norm.
Yes, but one of the differences, and you talk about drunk driving and certainly tobacco, but those things can be regulated by laws, and you don't have to smoke, and you certainly don't have to drive drunk. Everybody eats.
Well, that's true, and we're certainly not suggesting that people don't. It's very important, particularly if they eat healthy foods. I think, though, that we can look at other examples, things like mentoring children that have been ad council campaigns that certainly aren't regulated by law, but that we encourage people to do, and there's an incredible number of Americans that are volunteering on behalf of others and mentoring children and doing all kinds of wonderful things.
Mm-hmm. There are 100 of these small steps, share an entree with a friend, skip buffets, fetch the newspaper yourself. Are there going to be 100 spots?
100 spots? No. There are only 5 spots. And next year, as is our model, we will go back and refresh the work. So probably a year from now, we'll be bringing out a new round of work.
Okay. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255. Email TOTN at NPR.org. And let's begin with Alex, who's with us from Miami, Florida.
Yes. I had a question to your guest. I wanted to find out why she feels that the government should be involved in an individual's choice of what food, you know, he or she decides to eat.
Well, I don't think it's the government trying to tell people what to eat as much as it is encouraging them to adopt a healthy lifestyle. You know, the Health and Human Services is that department, and they really are, I believe, responsible for getting good information in front of the American people, and that's the spirit with which we entered into this partnership.
Mm-hmm. But given the fact that the government's proper role is to protect individual rights in a free society, why is it that the Department of Health is involved in this issue?
Well, I think I just explained that, and that is because in their role as a large healthcare provider, they really felt it's necessary to get this message out to the American people to encourage them and empower them to do things that will help them to lead a healthier lifestyle. It's very much based on choice.
So you don't think they have the capacity to decide for themselves as to what they should or should not eat?
Well, what about Alex? The same kind of messages were sent out about smoking. Do you feel the same way about that?
Certainly. Yes, I do.
Okay, so it's not a public health issue. It's not important for you.
No, it is important, but I think it's left to the individual. I mean, I think people are competent enough to decide what they can consume or what they choose not to consume, and they don't need the government to be involved in this. And as a matter of fact, I think it's a waste of tax money to have the government be involved in this, and it's not a proper role of the government.
Okay. Neil, I'd like to speak to the suggestion that it's a waste of tax money. Very, very little money was spent by the government because this was all done for free by the advertising agency. That's our model. And all of the media, it's not paid media. All of this media is donated by all of the broadcasting and cable organizations, print, outdoor. Mm-hmm. They pay no money at all for these messages because, you know, the advertising industry and the media industry in this country feels also that it's very important to get these empowering messages in front of the American people.
Alex?
Okay, but yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you. We wanted to move on.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate your time and the phone call. Alex's criticism is one side. Another group of critics might say that this campaign doesn't go far enough. Instead of drinking water or diet soda, which is one of the recommendations, why not no soda, no fast food? Why not push it further?
I think you have to go with the suggestions that people are really going to incorporate. I don't think that, just as we learned many, many years ago, that scolding people or raising the bar too high probably is going to turn them off. I think that suggesting that diet soda is one measure you can take is perfectly okay, because that will reduce the amount of calories that they take in every day.
I wonder, we're going to be talking most of the time about our personal responsibility for ourselves and our friends and our loved ones. Have you ever been on a diet?
I just finished losing 22 pounds.
And what was it that convinced you to do that?
Oh, everything. I just knew I would feel better. And it's very hard to do, especially the older you get. But I finally got the willpower together and did it.
Well, I hope you stay with it.
Thank you.
Peggy Conlon is the Ad Council's president and CEO. She joined us by phone from her office in New York City. And joining us now is Dr. James Early, director of clinical preventive medicine at the University of Kansas School of Medicine in Wichita. He joins us from his office. Nice of you to be with us today.
Thank you.
So, again, that same question. What is it that helps people decide to deal with their obesity? Is it messages like this?
Well, they can help. I think it's the general volume of clatter, actually. We have the idea today. I love the one person who called in who said it's not the government's job to be involved in this, and that people can make their own choices. And yet we're spending billions of dollars to convince people to eat badly.
Well,
so it's not like people are making their own choices in a vacuum. We have a world out there that is asking them to make bad choices, and now we're beginning to get the idea, hey, maybe we could do the same thing with good choice.
Well, he was talking about a waste of money. Are these kind of messages the best messenger? Or, as you say, is it a combination of things? And are people's friends, their families, are those the best messengers?
Well, you got to start somewhere. And certainly starting with messages that have a little humor and that aren't draconian are good background. 5 to 10% of people will make some changes based on those. The vast majority of people, however, will find it more difficult. And many of these simple suggestions we've been making for a long, long time, and they have not taken yet, mainly because the volume of other advice has been so strong out there.
So sort of the counter, the other side.
Right, yeah. Right. A balance beginning to occur.
So is there a time when people are more open to hearing about losing weight?
Oh, there are many times in our lives when we're open to it. Often when there's a family event that happens, when a loved one has become ill or died because of a lifestyle-related thing, we begin to think, boy, I better change, I better quit smoking, I better start getting in shape, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There are times, too, in our lives when we let it go. And one of those is the typical American male who is an athlete in his high school years and maybe even in college, and then gets married, gets a new job, they have a baby, he's working overtime trying to make ends meet, and the wife is trying to take care of the kids and at home. This is a time when things can really go south in terms of lifestyle. And so another time that it can be positive is in midlife, when we begin to see that my knee hurts a little, and boy, I really want to take that vacation, but I can't because I don't think I could walk if we went there. That kind of thing.
And if I could walk, it would be nice to see my feet.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But the knee pain that is crippling so many people in this country may be making the orthopedist wealthy, but it's certainly not doing a lot for our elderly as they want to enjoy their retired years. They won't be able to if they can't walk well.
We're talking about how to get people in our lives to tackle obesity. Those people, of course, include ourselves. And we're taking your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We'll be back with more after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're talking about how to help someone in losing weight. People who are overweight know it. So how do you help someone make such an important lifestyle change? What works? What doesn't? Of course, we want your input, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Dr. James Early, Director of Clinical Preventive Medicine at the University of Kansas School of Medicine in Wichita. And here's an email we got from Blaine Bellerud. As a fat guy, I feel very qualified to comment on this. Your starting comment, "What inspired you to lose weight," shows a basic assumption that non-fat people seem to be laboring under, i.e. that people are fat by choice, that something you say will suddenly wake them up and cause them to stop choosing to be fat. The whole personal responsibility movement promotes the idea that fat people are fat through some failure of willpower or character flaw, not a combination of genetic, evolutionary, and social factors, in addition to any exercise of individual choice that determines if a person is overweight or not. The blithe little small steps suggestions are along the lines of Nancy Reagan's "just say no" nonsense. Gee, none of those small steps occurred to me before.
That's excellent. I think he hit it. He hit the nail right on the head. We've just recently done a survey of physicians' attitudes, and basically, we've got to be much clearer about what causes obesity and what people are laboring under. This is excellent because I see hundreds and hundreds of people with weight problems. Many of these people are very, very successful in their lives. They have tremendous amounts of willpower, but we also know that they have a different set of social circumstances. They have biochemical differences from other people. I myself have been much heavier and lost weight. And maintaining that weight is a huge effort for me, where for some people it's a minor effort. But I can say while I am maintaining it, there's a level of anxiety that I'm fighting something natural in me by keeping the weight off. And the just say no message was far too simple. But the small steps message is simple too. It's simply not going to be enough. We've got to really be much more aggressive, and we've got to learn to talk to each other and about obesity, and that's something that we have not yet learned to do. We're afraid to talk to each other on the topic of obesity.
Well, what about his point in the email, though? I mean, he didn't choose to be fat, is his argument, and it's not so easy to choose to not be fat.
He's absolutely right. I mean, and everyone is different, but two things have happened. Number one, the society as a whole has changed dramatically in terms of the things that cause obesity, the availability of large numbers of calories, the jobs that don't demand physical activity. If you place a person who's genetically predisposed to be overweight in an environment that encourages it, you've got an epidemic, and that's exactly what we've got. In the old world, 50, 60 years ago, there were a few people that were very heavy, but a lot of other people that would have been much heavier, except the environment really was not conducive to gaining weight.
Let's get another caller on the line. Mary Beth is with us from Greensboro, North Carolina.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm hearing a lot of discussion about how to encourage adults to lose weight and maintain healthy lifestyles. I'm a fitness instructor and the mother of two young girls, and I'd like Dr. Early to address helping parents instruct their children, beginning at a very early age, on the benefits of a healthy lifestyle and a healthy diet. We spend an awful lot of time telling children the risks of using drugs or the risks of not doing well in school, but I'm not sure that parents really emphasize the physical nature of taking care of their own bodies. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for the call, Mary Beth.
Thanks.
Dr. Early?
Boy, she's right on. Recently, a study was published that showed that instructing parents was more powerful at helping kids maintain good weights than actually working with the kids. So what we're doing here is not just needing parents to tell their children what to do, but they need to role model. Hmm. Obviously, if we're going to turn things around, we have to begin to role model. Families have to begin to do things together. Good, nutritious foods, fruits and vegetables have to be available. The kids can help do the shopping. The kids can help do the cooking. And the family needs to get out and walk together. We don't need to be telling the kids to do something and then not doing them ourselves. That won't fly.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Early, thanks very much for being with us today.
You betcha.
James Early is Director of Clinical Preventive Medicine at the University of Kansas, and he joined us from his office in Wichita. And now with us from her office in Bethesda, Maryland, is Dr. Pamela Pika, an Assistant Professor of Medicine at the University of Maryland, a Pew Foundation Scholar in Nutrition, and she's also in private practice. Nice of you to take the time to speak with us today.
Oh, not a problem whatsoever.
So what is the best way, and I know the AMA came out with an instruction to doctors, you know, hey, you've all got to talk to your patients about fitness, but what's the best way for doctors to talk to their patients about obesity without causing more problems than they solve?
Well, let's take a step back here, Neil. What you have to understand is that the grand majority of physicians are not trained in this whatsoever. They know almost nothing about the basics of nutrition, let alone fitness. I teach at the University of Maryland to third and fourth year medical students, and the grand majority of the medical schools right now have no required topics whatsoever in nutrition and fitness. It doesn't appear on their boards. And then you expect these people to sit there and to be knowledgeable about these issues. If someone walks in with the metabolic syndrome, with high cholesterol, with lots of fat in their belly, with high blood pressure, et cetera, and they have a nice conversation about this, so that's why I take a step back, because a physician or any medical care professional, for that matter, really needs to be taught first the basics and to understand not just the numbers and the epidemiology behind it. That's fairly straightforward. We know where that's going.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have to understand that this is, this is a matter of psychology. It's a matter of being able to very sensitively, discuss this with men and women and children and adolescents and families who are very traumatized by a lot of this. You know, this has affected almost every piece of their life. And physicians have had no formal training whatsoever in doing this well. And that's why I'm a bit of a mutant, Neil. As you know, I have formal training in this. I mean, gosh, it's, me and a half a dozen folk out there, and this is ridiculous. Every single physician in America, every single nurse, all the medical care professionals need to know how to do this.
And so give us a little hint about how to do it. I mean, obviously every patient is different, but...
Well, yeah, well, the first thing you don't do is you walk up to someone and say, hello, you're obese. We found out by surveys that have been done recently that when you just sort of lay it out there and you use a lot of technical language, well, obesity and body mass index and the rest of it, they stop listening, okay, because you're not hearing where they're coming from.
Hmm.
You know, as these other wonderful, people who have called in on the show thus far has made very clear, they need you to hear them. They have a story. There are medical conditions. There's genetics in play. There's environmental situations. There's lifestyle issues.
But if I've got cancer, I don't want to hear euphemisms. I want to hear what I've got.
Absolutely. Well, the part of the piece of this is, people want a solution. But, ironically, as physicians describe what they believe the solution should be, which hopefully is an integrative approach of looking at, everything from psychology to nutrition to fitness, it must be integrative. They must, therefore, have a system to be able to support that integrative approach. We in the United States today, as medical professionals, do not yet have any national system, number one.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, when physicians are able to put it together, they did it by themselves. They called up a psychologist or a licensed social worker who can, help with that, the psychology behind so much of this, provide the support, the coaching. They've called up nutritionists. They've networked with them. Many physicians now hire registered dietitians to actually work with them because they themselves, certainly not in an 8-minute classic, physician's office visit, that we see so often, can really sit down and give due diligence to this. Respect that person in front of you. Listen to them. Go where they are. Ironically, Neil, the motivation that you think that, so many of these wonderful men and women have, or should have to be able to make a change really is different than what you think. I have people who come in with coronary bypasses, who already have diabetes, other issues, and yet that's not enough yet to change. What does it take to get into that place of readiness? That's where you have to go, where the person is. It takes time to listen to them and understand what's going to click upstairs and to nurture that along. That takes time.
Let's get some more callers on the line. This is Jill, and Jill's with us from Minneapolis.
Hi, I just want to speak to the very sensitive issue of one-on-one, person-to-person talking about you got to lose weight. Just be really careful, because as a formerly overweight person, I've had it happen, and it just, you might smile on the outside and say, fine, I know, but it just, it's a dagger on the inside. Just very sensitive, particularly if the person delivering the comment is a thin person. So just be very careful on that. I like the Small Steps campaign. You know, it's a third party, not involved in your personal life. And it's, I may have heard it before, but it's reinforcement, and that reading reinforcement can be very good.
What worked for you, Jill? You say you're a formerly fat person.
Yeah, I actually, what turned the corner for me was aging and the very real health ramifications that come with that. You can get away with it when you're in your 30s, et cetera, but mid-40s now, and I was seeing things happen to people around me that age, so that did it for me.
And
done yet either.
No, well, none of us are. It's kind of one of those eternal battles, isn't it?
Right, exactly. So I'll go off the air and listen.
Thanks very much for the phone call, Joe.
Thanks.
And Dr. Peek, I wonder, do men and women come in with different approaches to this?
Absolutely. Boy, that last caller was just wonderful in bringing that out. It's now what we call, Neil, gender-specific medicine. It's a brand new way of looking at this. And one of the first researchers to really look at this was Dr. James Hill at the University of Colorado. He heads up the National Weight Control Registry out there in Denver. And this is a success. This is a very interesting story. An ongoing study of 4,000 men and women. We call them the successful losers, for a nice oxymoron.
Mm-hmm.
And what they've done is they've removed, as it were, an average of 65 pounds and kept it off for over 10 years. And so we study them, these successful people. And this is what we found. Men and women are motivated oftentimes very differently. Men will oftentimes come in with a specific issue. You know, they'll say, well, you know, I don't want to go on that statin drug and, you know, ruin my, you know, liver. I don't want to be placed on this particular high blood pressure medicine because it'll affect other pieces of my life. So
suddenly the phrase erectile dysfunction comes into your mind.
You got it. Yes. Absolutely. And no question about that. And so they'll come in with specifics. They'll take down a blueprint and they'll just basically go with it. Interestingly, women many times will come in with a more of a mixture of both some of that statistics. You know, they'll say, well, you know, blood pressure, diabetes, whatever. But they'll also have a tremendous amount of feeling about it. They'll say, I am just tired of being tired. I am tired of being, you know, of not feeling good about myself. I lack energy, you know, this kind of a thing. In addition to which, oh, by the way, I'm on 3 cardiac medications or whatever. Yeah. And so we see a gender specificity there, which is very interesting. Also, the way men and women approach it. Men are negotiators, all right? Now, this is the deal, Dr. Peek. You know, I love my Doritos, all right? It's Super Bowl time. For you, I'll eat half of them, but I'm not going to give them all up, and don't make me eat chick food, you know? Whereas women will say, well, gosh, you know, I'll change everything overnight. You know, I want to be a much better person. I'll never eat another Dorito. So we have to control women from going to that perfection place and just say, look, let's get real, small steps, integrate high quality and check the quantity of the foods. And with men, we continue the negotiation over quality and quantity. It's kind of interesting as we play both. But again, medical professionals, everyone involved in this, need to be sensitive to these differences, these vulnerabilities, and yet at the same time strengths that we can work with.
We're talking about what, if anything, will work to get people to make the decision to diet and exercise and help control their weight. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email we got from Chris from Manayunk. I'm a robust person, as is my wife. We both sat down and talked one night about candidly about our health and decided together to get healthy. We decided we weren't ever going to attain supermodel status, but have been consciously working together to develop healthier habits from diet to exercise. We have joined a gym, adopted a dinner menu that allows us a night to enjoy our favorite foods and have healthy dinners the rest of the week. We have, pardon the pun, fed off compliments and positive reinforcements between each other to strive for fitness. I think the key has been teamwork and, equally as important, realistic goals.
Wow. Neil, I'm smiling ear to ear here for a lot of reasons. Number one, research shows that when you do it together, whether it's a family, a couple, however you want to do it, when you've got that support system, the success rates are tenfold over those people who are just struggling alone or basically in an environment where nobody's really supporting them. And that's why it's really important to see how successful you can do this. And look at the reason why they did this. Together, they had a conversation. And it wasn't about, you know, changing their complete lives overnight. Again, going back to the small step issues again. Let's get up. Let's get more active. Come on. Let's start addressing the issue of quality and quantity of food.
Is it common for couples to work on this together? Now we
enter a little, you know, the landmine area here. Well, you know, to be perfectly blunt with you, you know, Neil, I've seen everything from soup to nuts on this one. I have couples who come in who say they're together, but really one person may be threatened by the other person's success or back and forth. See, really, I love to see couples together so I can kind of, you know, straighten this out with them right off the bat. How many people really do it well together? A goodly number. I would say easily up to half. But the other half is sort of a bit of a mix, and you have to kind of watch it for what it is. Because this involves, especially people who have been living together for a while, this involves a dynamic relationship situation where, you know, you're changing everything. You're changing appearance. You're changing your scheduling. All of a sudden, now you're at a gym instead of staying home watching television. You're not there unless you're with that person. So you have to kind of watch it that way. I love that supportive system, however.
Yeah, but in a couple's relationship, it's always dangerous if one of them is sort of smugly there a little bit further ahead than the other one.
Well, yeah, and that's why you have to. This is a beautiful, you know, opportunity here to learn how to communicate better. You can't food police. Oh, dear God, don't go there. You know, you can't nag. That's another, you know, terrible thing to do.
Right.
What you do is you just nurture. Things like, well, I'm going to go out for my walk right now. Hey, would you like to join me? No, if not, I'll be back in about 45 minutes. You see, I offered an opportunity. That's all I did. And if you want to come with me, fine.
Email from Jane Pop. Losing weight sensibly is expensive. If health insurance would cover a portion of the cost for athletic clubs and diet programs such as Weight Watchers, you could get more people losing weight.
Well, you want to know something? There is absolutely no question that public policy-wise, we need to have a little conversation with the insurance companies about this. Now, interestingly, you know, go figure. If you go see a physician and by this time you already have high cholesterol and all these other issues, your insurance pays for it. But if you're coming in almost preventatively, you don't have anything yet on paper, your blood pressure is still okay, but yet, you know, you do have an extra 40 to 50 pounds on board and you're feeling unhealthy, you know, oftentimes they won't pay for that because, and I quote, there's nothing yet wrong with you. You see what's wrong with this whole, you know, system. And we obviously need to address that in a significant sort of way. But let me tell you something else, though, Neil.
And we're running out of time in the segment, so if you could keep it very quick.
Okay. America on the Move is the new nonprofit association nationally that Tommy Thompson now is supporting as head of HHS. It's all about going into the community in every state in the country, and it's all about simply moving an extra 100 calories a day, eating 100 calories less, and literally dropping 20 to 25 pounds by simply doing that every single year.
We'll have more with Dr. Pamela Peek after a short break and talk about physical education in schools. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And today we're talking about obesity, and our guest is Dr. Pamela Peek, an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Maryland and a Pew Foundation scholar in nutrition. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Micah, who's with us from Scottsdale, Arizona.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I've been struggling with my weight since I was 5 years old, and I was put on my first diet when I was 8 by a doctor. And for me, over the last several decades, the issue of medical intervention in terms of obesity has not been a very relevant one. As much as obvious as it is that the doctors who study obesity and wish to, you know, alleviate that problem in people, as obvious as their good intentions are, for a lot of people, food is an addiction the way alcohol is an addiction for a lot of people, and medical intervention doesn't always help. So for those people who are out there listening, there are other options, but I have never been able personally to get help, really permanent, meaningful help from doctors when it comes to my weight problems and my issues with food.
Dr. Peek?
I just wanted to put that out there. I don't know if they have a comment on it or not.
Dr. Peek?
I say amen. Absolutely. It's the reason why I rant and rave about this whole issue in the first place. Look, the system's not set up for that. We never even looked at it in, with the kind of research that you're really talking about up until very recently. Heck, we just found the obesity gene like we needed to find it, and there it was. But we're just now beginning to understand the incredibly complex mechanisms involved with this. Hey, now listen, interestingly enough, we're now beginning to understand the addictive nature of something like processed sugar. Very recently, beautiful research was published about 6 months ago looking at the cross-linking between alcoholism, even if you don't have alcoholism, but if you carry it in your genome, and sugar addiction. Because the grand majority of people who have an issue with one definitely have an issue with another. And certainly if it's carried in your family line, what an interesting thing. We're beginning to understand that what you just said has a very powerful biochemical base. You can't just deal with that with just psychology, for instance, alone, this whole issue of just stop doing it.
Mm-hmm.
No. It's very complex because it involves physiology, anatomy, biochemistry, genetics, genome.
Doctor, doesn't that...
make another point?
Go ahead, Micah.
Yeah, thank you. It's very interesting to me in my little adventures dealing with my food addiction is that I meet a lot of people who have stopped drinking and who have then picked up food. And I know that...
And cigarettes, I will add.
Cigarettes. But the issue is a lot of it really is the unprocessed, the very processed foods, and the fact that once alcoholics put down alcohol, which has a good deal of sugar in it or is processed into sugar in the body, they end up looking for that in the food.
There's
absolutely they suck down, you know, quantities of chocolate and refined sugar. So,
well, let me ask Dr. Peek, the problem you're describing and the genetic component and the environmental component, all that, does that suggest that, things that we were talking about earlier in the program, the small steps campaign for people like Micah, this doesn't seem like anything like a solution?
You know what you're finding, honestly, Neil? You're finding that one size does not fit all here. That, you know, we're going to be looking at subclasses of this problem where, you know, in some people it's more of an addictive issue. In other people it may involve a medical condition that has nothing to do with that. In other people it's just sheer genetics. Other people they're clueless about, you know, what's going on with lifestyle and back and forth. You're going to find that there are multiple layers to this. And what you have to do with every single person is you have to sit down and you have to listen and you have to do the checklist. What is it that's predominant in what this one person said? She's obviously got a significant issue with addiction, and she knows that. It's that, you know, processed sugar thing, whereas the next person it isn't. You're going to find it's not one size fits all. And I think that would be – that's true of so much. We have, for instance, subcategories of hypertension. Why shouldn't it be true here?
Micah, thank you very much for the phone call.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. And Dr. Peek, we appreciate your time today as well.
Oh, thank you very much.
Pamela Peek is a practicing physician. She helps both doctors and patients tackle obesity, and she was with us from her office in Bethesda, Maryland.